Our opening words this morning are by Kirk D. Lodeman Copeland. We are called to gather in worship as beloved community. We are called to set aside distractions and anxieties that we might touch deeper springs and be renewed. We are called to seek and to share comfort for the hurts that afflict. We are called to desire more love, more justice, and life more abundant. We are called to truth, to mercy, to humility, and to courage. Let us answer the call with the yes of our lives. Now is it time, Michelle?
Now it's time.
All right.
All right. So Cindy and I are going to do a little message together, but I'm going to start with asking, what is special and about Tuesday? What is important that's happening on Tuesday? I'm going to go right to the senior youth. What's special about Tuesday, my friends? Emmett, what? Election Day.
Election
that was Liz.
Day.
Thank you. Election Day. And Election Day, for those of you that might not know, is when we go, adults get to vote. And they vote for things that are important to them, and they vote to keep things the same or to make some changes. And there's always different views on what should stay the same and what should change. But today we're going to do a little vote. But the only people that get to vote today is this group right here. So you have a lot of power in your hands today.
This is representative democracy.
Yes.
You're representing democracy for everyone else.
All right. And today they're voting whether we should have lollipops in Fellowship Hall for snack or pretzels in Fellowship Hall for snack. No one here can give their opinion, okay, because they're going to the polls and they're going to vote, and no one can tell you what to vote when you're in the polls. So we just want you to know, like, if you think we should have lollipops for snack, will you please raise your hand? One, two. If you think we should have pretzels for snack, will you please raise your hand? Oh, so pretzels won. So we'll have pretzels
won.
And we'll just put the lollipops. Reagan, wait a minute. I'm noticing you're looking a little upset. Why is that? You don't like pretzels. Well, but they voted.
Fair. That was fair, right? They voted.
Why wasn't it fair? Because not everybody got to vote. In this country, guess what? Mostly everybody
gets
to vote. So now let's do it again. Now everyone can vote, including those people up there that I'm hoping I see all your phones go away. That was the director of religious education coming out.
No phones.
All right,
voting
no phones during voting. So if you think we should have lollipops for snacks, stand up.
Or raise your hand
if you can't stand up, yeah. If you think we should have, now you can sit down. If you think we should have pretzels for snacks, stand up. Oh, pretzels won again.
Pretzels wins again. Pretzels won in first service,
oh.
too.
Oh. So, are there... Oh, wait.
What?
Who said
what
that?
Was that?
Oh, wait. Can we vote to have both?
Could we vote to have both?
Sure, we can change.
Can we change the paradigm?
Yeah, because would that make it more fair?
What?
All right. So, if you think we should offer both lollipops and pretzels, please stand up. It was not unanimous, but certainly most people thought that. So today we will offer both in Fellowship Hall. So I'm wondering, because this was an easy vote. It's not really serious. Your lives would not really change.
It is not.
If you had a lollipop or a pretzel, that's not really going to change your life. But some of the things we're voting on will change people's lives. It'll change people's jobs. It'll change people's lives. It will maybe, hopefully, change some lives in a real positive way. But however, like we just talked, when this group was the only one voting, it didn't really represent everyone. There are groups being kept away from voting even this year. I would have thought that happened a long time ago, but it's still happening now. And Cindy's going to tell you some of the things that are happening in this world that people have put into place to make sure other people don't get the right to vote.
That's right. So we like to think in America that all citizens who are adults get to vote. And of course, many of our kids know that that wasn't always the case, right? There were certain people who we didn't let vote back in history. Do you know about that? Who did we not let vote?
Women.
Women, right. Who else did we not let vote? Black people, right. Anybody else? Native Americans, Indians, yes. And who? Non-property owners couldn't vote at certain periods in our history, too, right. And even in my lifetime, there was a group of adults that were between the ages of 18 and 21 who couldn't vote, right? Some of you older folks in the congregation may remember not getting to vote when you were 18, but you were still old enough to be in the military. And that didn't... Yeah? Right. So that was 1971 when we changed that. Today, there are still groups of people who are being disenfranchised in their vote. So in Randolph County, Georgia, they had 9 polling places before, and they've closed 7 of them, and leaving only 2. That makes it harder for people to vote. And this is disproportionately affecting African-American voters. Also in Georgia, thousands of people have had their voter registrations taken back because of things like typos on their registration. These are new voters who have been disenfranchised from voting. So it's disproportionately affecting new voters, which affects the young, and disproportionately affecting African Americans because, guess what? We spell their names wrong more often. In New Hampshire, it's become harder for college students to vote. Even though we lowered that voting age to 18, they're having to prove that they're permanent residents of the state with new restrictions on that, and that's affecting younger voters. In Florida, the governor banned early voting on college campuses, which makes it harder for college students to vote, too. In Dodge City, Kansas, the only polling place was moved. They had one place where you could vote, and that was in the center of town, which most people could walk to, had sidewalks, buses went there. They moved it to outside of town, where there's no bus stop and no sidewalks, and people have a harder time getting there. And that's affecting the large Latino population there. And in North Dakota, you have to have a street address now, not just a post office box, in order to vote. And guess who that's affecting? Right, Native Americans, the Indians, because on the reservations, they don't have street addresses. And so they're having to scramble to create street addresses in order to let the Native Americans vote there. And numerous states have for years had restrictions on whether or not you can vote if you're someone who has been in jail for a felony conviction, been in prison, and has finished your prison time. Can you vote? Only 2 states, Maine and Vermont, let people vote while they're in prison. And the rest of them, you have to wait till you're out. But sometimes then, there are still restrictions on your voting rights, particularly in Florida, where 10% of their state population can't vote because of felony convictions. So those are just a few ways in which, while we try to say in America, everybody gets a vote, we are still not living up to our American dream.
So hopefully, as we all vote on Tuesday, and as you all get older and get to be a voting age, you will use that right that you have to help other people get the rights that they should have.
Our words for prayer or meditation this morning come from Rabbi Harold Kushner and are titled, A Prayer for the World. Let the rain come and wash away the ancient grudges, the bitter hatreds held and nurtured over generations. Let the rain wash away the memory of the hurt, the neglect. Then let the sun come out and fill the sky with rainbows. Let the warmth of the sun heal us wherever we are broken. Let it burn away the fog so that we can see each other clearly, so that we can see beyond labels, beyond accents, gender, or skin color. Let the warmth and brightness of the sun melt our selfishness so that we can share the joys and feel the sorrows of our neighbors. And let the light of the sun be so strong that we will see all people as our neighbors. Let the earth, nourished by rain, bring forth flowers to surround us with beauty. And let the mountains teach our hearts to reach upward to heaven. Amen. So the election sermon has a grand tradition in our faith. UU minister Forrest Church, in a sermon titled Religion and the Body Politic, talks about how the election sermon, preached the Sunday before a major election, is a long-standing tradition in our faith and in American denominations in general since at least the 17th century. He writes this, "It's a great literary genre. Often the brimstone was so hot that an election day sermon was the one sermon a minister might be remembered by. There was a reason for that. No words were minced. He entered the pulpit, and for the next 2 hours, count your blessings, folks, proclaimed a Jeremiad, as in Jeremiah, the great Hebrew prophet. Here's how it went. The world has gone, or is about to go, to hell. The reason is simple. God is punishing you for your sins. Whatever is wrong in this world is wrong because you are wrong-headed, wrong-hearted, inattentive to God's commandments, and God is watching, and God is angry. And if you keep on messing up, you will burn forever. Of course, the election sermon has changed just a little bit from the days of that Forest Church writes about to the point where it's a very different concept in our churches today. Another UU minister, the Reverend Fran Dearman, writes, "Now, an election sermon is very simple. If times are good, one says, it can't last, so pay attention. If times are not so good, one says, so pay attention, but this too shall pass. And whatever the times, one urges folks to get involved, vote, run for office, get out there and do something, and bring your best self and highest ideals to the task. Which I urge you to do, she says, whatever party and whatever cause compels you. The next most important thing about an election sermon is that it's not about the election." Wise words from the Reverend Dearman. Of course, this is not at all about the election. After all, I'm now here in Massachusetts where we have early voting, and I'm guessing that quite a lot of you have already voted. Is that the case? How many have voted already? Almost three quarters, I would say. And what are the rest of you waiting for? You like to do it on election day, right? You enjoy the ritual of that, the standing in lines and chatting with your neighbors and the seeing how many people are out. It's a big, grand event, yes? Yeah, I missed that. But I decided to vote early anyway, just because I could for the first time ever. So I'm guessing that the rest of you who haven't voted, the last thing you want me to do is stand up here and tell you how to vote, right? And how many people want me to stand up here and tell people how to vote? One, two. That's two more than the 9 o'clock crew. This is, of course, about something else. And what then? It is, as it always is, about our values and about what's at stake. One important thing our faith tells us in this election, as in every election, is to vote. Our fifth principle in Unitarian Universalism is the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. We believe in this. We say both in our congregations, which we run democratically without the hierarchy and absolute authority of a bishopric or papacy, and we also say in society at large. We don't just stop with running our churches with democracy. We say that we believe in taking this democratic process out into the world. We believe it's important to be voters ourselves and to encourage others to be voters regardless of their political party, because the act of voting itself has religious and moral value. So that's the first way we live our faith at this time of year. We vote and we encourage others to vote. It's a simple act, theoretically, long lines aside, but it's one of the most profound we make as citizens. We hear all the time that people are worried that this group or that group will stay home from the polls. We religiously do not belong to this group or that group. You often hear it with regard to evangelicals. Evangelicals had a particularly high turnout for one election or a low turnout for one election, or are not expected to turn out because nothing of their values is on the ballot particularly, or they are expected to turn out because of specific issues on the ballot. Their vote has to do with those issues and those candidates. It's not about the religious importance of voting overall. That's where our faith differs. If you did not care about any of the candidates, try to imagine that for a minute. If you didn't care about any of the candidates, and if there were no major issues at stake in this election, try to imagine that, nothing big that you care about in this election at all, how many of you would still go and vote? The vast majority. That's something we're pretty united on as Unitarian Universalists. We vote whether or not we think it matters, whether or not we think it's important. for any particular election. We vote because voting is important. And I'm guessing you probably believe in casting a pretty informed vote, too, yeah? Anybody go and research the little races when there are little races? None of you. Okay, never mind. Just kidding. Ah. Right. So the question was, do you go out and research the little, the smaller candidates on the ballot? Still only some. This election, not so many of those smaller races, I think. It's just part of that. Of course, there are a lot more issues that are values issues, faith issues at stake in this election. Immigration, reproductive freedom, transgender rights, health care, workers' rights, economic justice, sexism, sexual harassment, climate change, lots more. I'm sure I didn't even mention your favorite topic. All of these have faith components, values components. We can easily look to the Unitarian Universalist responsive resolutions and actions of immediate witness that we've made as a faith and find documents which link our faith to each and every one of these issues. And for many of us, there may be one or two that pop out as most central as to how we decide who we vote for. It might be climate change or health care or LGBTQ rights or reproductive freedom. And there are sometimes personal concerns that we have that override our values. For example, you may feel that a particular candidate has such an important stance on health care that that overrides their negative stances on other issues for you. And so it goes with every decision we make. We have personal needs sometimes that can trump some of our other values, and that mean that we might think the economy or jobs might make a particular candidate a better candidate for us, even if they don't stand for combating climate change or economic justice. And those are your decisions to make. And it's not my place to tell you how to vote and how to weigh your values and your decisions. What it is my place to say is that they are values that are our shared values. And those values, as always, are at stake in this election and in the days to come afterwards. And weigh them in and consider them carefully. But no matter who you voted for already or will vote for on Tuesday, and no matter what the outcome in Tuesday's election, there's more that we need to do to live out our values in this world. And the truth is, in the last 2 years in particular, but even somewhat before that, I've become disillusioned with my previous answer to the problems in this country, which was simply to vote and get out the vote, to encourage people to engage in the democratic process in that particular method. That particular method, voting, the voting process, has led us to putting the civil rights of a group of people up to popular vote for the first time in Massachusetts history. And I think it's wrong that we get to vote about that. I think it's wrong that we are voting for or against a group of people. And the fact that we're doing so means that something is broken in our system. There are other signs that democracy is broken in some fundamental ways to me, too, and that voting in particular is broken. In our hyperpartisan times, for example, it's become increasingly obvious that the Supreme Court isn't an independent branch of our government. It's a branch appointed by presidents, and those presidents are highly partisan. And they appoint judges who, in turn, reinforce their presidential views and their rights as presidents. We saw the Supreme Court decide a president in Bush v. Gore, and we'll see it sometime soon, perhaps, in whether or not a president can be indicted. But about voting particularly, how is democracy broken? This is also a time, well, with set aside voting for a second, this is also a time when the free press is under attack, when white supremacists and white nationalists are appealed to in covert and overt statements of support, when we're pulling out of international agreements and making enemies of longtime allies, and when lies to the American people are so commonplace that many of us have become jaded about them and about whether or not anything can be done. So those are other pieces of the democratic process where things need fixing. And then there's voting rights. There's the blatant ways that voting rights are being stripped of people across this country. Not just through the things I listed earlier in our Time for All Ages, but also the gerrymandering process of districts and how so many districts are gerrymandered that a particular political party can't win, no matter how much the vote is turned over. They can't take back over a state legislature in many states. And then beyond gerrymandering, there's how the district lines are drawn and that process being so highly partisan in many of our states that it's impossible to get the lines drawn in a way that is fair and balanced. And then beyond that, we have the Electoral College embedded into our Constitution, which is perhaps the biggest gerrymander of all, set up to systematically disenfranchise groups of people, and it does so more and more as our populations become more polarized into areas of the country. So I think, yes, we still vote. Voting still matters. But yes, there is more to be done. Win or lose in this election, whatever your side, there is more to be done after we vote. And I want to say our belief in the democratic process doesn't end with voting, and it doesn't preclude us from taking and exercising other methods than the democratic process to effect change. So what else do we do? First, we lobby. We go to our representatives. We tell them our point of view. We show up at town hall meetings and city council meetings and school board meetings, and we make use of the open microphone time to advance our agenda, whatever it is. I saw this at work, particularly in Michigan, since I was there for the last 14 years, and it took us showing up at a city council for 10 years, 20 years really, before we got them to vote on passing LGBTQ protections there in our city. But what changed it, in part, after 20 years, was that we got incredibly persistent. There were people at every open microphone, at every city council meeting, for months, lined up to queue on this particular issue, hammering it over and over again until finally the city council said, we better just vote so they'll stop coming. And they put it to a vote. And if you can't get the government to hold hearings on your issue, to listen and put your agenda on the table, you hold meetings on your own. I worked with local clergy a few years ago that did this on Black Lives Matter issues, pushing for certain reforms in policing. And we held the meetings ourselves and got the police to sit down at the table and listen to our concerns and promise certain changes. We can organize. If you're in a rental unit, you can create a tenants association. If you're a worker in a company or a school, you can unionize. If you're in a neighborhood, you can create residential organizations. If you're in a religion, you can work with our statewide advocacy organizations and denominational organizations and other churches and places of worship around to create change. We did this on question three in our church, organizing a meeting to bring up the issue and share information on it. If you're in a school, you can work with the student association or create one. And we can protest. Protest used to create a lot of change. How many people remember the protests of the 60s and how much change we created back then as a country? Right. I don't remember it. I wasn't born yet. But I've heard about it all my life. It feels sometimes today, I think, like that power of protest to create change has been lost. We still protest and nothing changes. I think for me, I saw that first in the Iraq War, where it felt like we were protesting so much in the state, and the president learned of the ability to just completely ignore protests. In a new book, The End of Protest, by Micah White, he argues that the power of protest is broken, but not irrevocably. He argues that it is still possible to win, but we have to change how we do things. We need to move from thinking about protest to thinking about revolution, he argues. Now, revolution can be a scary word because we think of it as overturning the government completely, like the Revolutionary War when we overturned British rule. But we also talk about things like the Industrial Revolution, when we moved to a whole new way of doing things in our country and world because of innovation, and that innovation brought change. Michael White uses a definition by Lyford P. Edwards from 1927. He says, "Revolution is a change brought about not necessarily by force and violence, whereby one system of legality is terminated and another originated. So revolution, in this definition, is changing the system of laws. So, by way of example, imagine that we believe that the current prison industrial system is irrevocably broken. We think that sentencing and fixing sentencing laws alone isn't going to be enough to change the system where black people are incarcerated at greater rates than white Americans. And so not only do we have to fix the sentencing laws, we have to go back from that and fix how often people are convicted of different races and the discrepancy there. But that's not just the beginning of the problem. We have to go back to the next step and say, who is chosen to be prosecuted? Go back from there to say, who do we arrest? And then, and this whole system is so intertwined and so large that it is impossible to simply just change it. It's broken to a point where we need to revolutionize it. That's revolution. That's when we move from simply voting to civil disobedience to change things. The fight for civil rights, for those of you who remember the fights for civil rights, we're still in some of them today, are full of instances of revolution, of breaking laws to change and challenge unjust systems of laws. Civil disobedience from Thoreau on consists of breaking laws in protest, whether that's sitting in somewhere or lying down in the street and blocking traffic, or like Thoreau refusing to pay your taxes. My aunt and uncle every year write their check for their taxes to the Department of Education. The government still cashes them. White has 8 principles for revolution. I'm not going to list all 8. You can read his book, The End of Revolution. I'm going to talk about just one of them, spirit. He says, to be weak and to win requires spirit, the inner force that grants patience, perseverance, and resilience in the face of adversity. As activists, we launch protests knowing that we will be outnumbered for several years prior to victory. Defeat in specific engagements does not break our spirit because of our profound assurance that victory is inevitable. This really resonated with me. When I get depressed about the state of the world, I think back often to the suffragists for inspiration. The suffragists were people who had no right to vote, but that didn't stop them from eventually gaining it. They worked for decades. They marched in the streets. They created organizations all across America. They held conventions. They gave speeches. They lobbied their representatives, and they committed acts of civil disobedience. They went in and voted and were arrested for doing so. And the first suffragists were largely dead by the time they succeeded, but succeed they did. The same thing happened in the fight for voting rights for African Americans. One of our most recent amendments to the Constitution was also about voting. It was the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age to 18. And before that, you could fight for our country and die for our country for 3 years before you could vote for our country in our country. And the young people of this country who were without vote, they got that law changed the same way the suffragists did, and the same way we worked to vote, extend voting rights to African Americans. They protested. They marched in the streets. They created organizations. They gave speeches. They lobbied their representatives. They committed acts of civil disobedience. And the Constitution was changed, and they got the vote. We've shown time and time again in this country that even without the vote, it's possible to change our country. We're having a harder time doing it now, but it is still possible. So yes, this election sermon is not about the election. It's about after the election, despite the election, because we're still going to need to work together to combat climate change. Regardless of who wins on Tuesday, we need to come together and work on immigration reform. Whoever represents us in Boston or in Washington, D.C., we, the people, will continue to have to fight for LGBTQ rights and particularly transgender rights. A vote happens this week. But the work of living into our principle about the democratic process continues each and every day after. May it be so. Our closing words are by Ken Sawyer. whoever wins or loses in the races on Tuesday, or in the next or the next beyond them. Let us bear our little victories with humility and our defeats with grace. In the midst of whatever may come, may we be spared from vengeance and bitterness alike. May instead we be graced with laughter, perspective, gentleness, forbearance, patience, and peace. Amen.